I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Thanksgiving marks the start of a month-long eating binge. Then come holiday parties, Christmas and Hanukkah, New Year's, and finally January, when new gym memberships skyrocket. But for teens and young adults with eating disorders, food, weight, and body image are a year-round preoccupation. The idea of starving yourself or purging food after meals seems strange to us, but to someone with anorexia or bulimia, it's the logical thing to do. This hour, psychologist Wes Crenshaw talks about eating disorders, how images in pop culture reinforce the idea that thin is better at all costs, and what you can do to help. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here come the holidays, and for teens and young adults with eating disorders, here come issues. For young people who suffer from anorexia or bulimia, weight and food and body images are concerns all the time, and it's only made worse at this time of year. Today, a conversation with Dr. Wes Crenshaw about young people and eating disorders, which afflicts thousands. Dr. Wes Crenshaw co-authors the Double Take Advice column for teens and their parents in the Lawrence Journal World and is the author of the books Dear Dr. Wes, Real Life Advice for Teens and Real Life Advice for Parents of Teens. Wes, always good to have you.
And it's always nice to be here.
And he brought with us a guest with him today, Katie Gio, who worked with Wes on the Double Take column. She's a senior at Free State High School in Lawrence, where she edits her school newspaper, and she struggled with anorexia. Katie, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Great
Gio,
to be here.
Right?
Yep, it's a hard one.
Yeah. Well, Wes, how common are eating disorders among young people these days? What are you seeing out there?
Well, all total, the National Institutes of Mental Health estimate about 1.7 teens will have an eating disorder during their adolescence.
1.7 teens out
1.7%.
Okay, yeah.
Teens,
just 1.7, why are we doing a show?
Yeah, it's only one teen. 1.7 teens.
Yeah.
And those break down, and I believe it's about 0.6 or 0.5% for anorexia and a little bit more for bulimia, and then about a point for people of overeating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Katie, what are you seeing at Lawrence Free State High School? What's happening over there when it comes to, I guess, girls mainly who are afflicted with these kinds of eating disorders?
Well, actually, it's not very common to hear people talk about eating disorders publicly. And so I really don't know any people personally. And a lot of people didn't know that I was anorexic until this morning when we released a column, which I thought was interesting because I thought it was pretty obvious. But you can definitely tell that girls are afraid of gaining weight. Not all, of course, but for instance, on Pinterest and Facebook and Twitter, you see a lot of girls talking about dieting, and they aren't fat. I mean, we're teenagers. A lot of us could still stand to gain some weight, muscle mass. But yeah, dieting has become a huge trend.
Well, what did you write in your column today? In the Lawrence Journal World, I gather? Is that where it appeared?
Right, right.
What did you write?
Well, I basically just shared my recovery story. I hope that maybe by hearing how I recovered from 90 pounds that maybe people out there who are still struggling with anorexia or bulimia or another eating disorder can see that there is hope for being where I am today, which is pretty happy and healthy.
I gather you're getting some response already by what you wrote.
Yes, I've gotten a few texts from friends who were surprised, which surprised me because, you know, a few people had noticed that I had dropped 25 pounds, but apparently it wasn't as obvious as I thought.
We should say that you've been through a whole treatment and recovery program. What year were you in school when you were at 90 pounds?
That was my sophomore year in high school.
Okay. That gives you a little time context for it.
And today you're a junior or a senior?
A senior.
Senior. Okay, so it was a couple years ago then. Yeah.
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit about your story, Katie, while we're there. What happened to you? Tell us your story.
Well, I guess to understand me, you have to understand that I'm a perfectionist, first of all. I have to get A's, straight A's, 4.0. I am obsessed with perfection, or at least I used to be. I'm getting better at that.
Yeah.
But in eighth grade, I became very upset with myself all areas of myself. And that fueled into body image. And so I started to believe that I was fat, that there was this pouch of fat over my stomach that really I later learned is just part of being a woman. But at the time, I thought that, wow, I am obese. And so I started...
How much did you weigh, can I ask?
115 pounds, and I was 5'6". Wow. Interesting story, I'm now 5'5". so possibly anorexia did something there.
But you were convinced at 115 pounds you were obese.
Oh, yeah. And I was only focusing on this one tiny area of my stomach, so I wasn't looking at any other part of myself except for that little area. And if that wasn't as flat as a board, I was having a bad day.
Wow. Wow. And so how did you get down the road to anorexia? What did you go through?
Well, I actually started very, very briefly trying to be bulimic and figured out pretty quickly that bulimia does not work very well. It's actually kind of counterproductive. If anything, I gained 3 pounds. So very quickly, I started limiting my calories until I was consuming much less than 1,000 a day and started dropping weight drastically.
You know, maybe, Wes, this is a good time to clarify some terms here, anorexia versus bulimia. Similar things, but very different, too.
Yeah, very different. There are different psychological dynamics. One of the things that I think people don't realize about these disorders is that it isn't a matter of not understanding proper nutrition. One of the first interventions that families will try to do with their typically daughter, but sons too sometimes, is head down to the nutritionist and spend time learning how to eat. And I told Katie this morning on the ride in, I've never met an anorexic who wasn't smarter about nutrition than any nutritionist. Mm. They know if a carrot is 2 inches long, how many calories it has in it versus if it's 3 inches long. And that's not the problem. This is a psychological problem. It isn't.
And people get confused on
that point. They do. They do. And it isn't that a nutritionist isn't helpful in treating anorexia or bulimia. It is that that isn't the sole problem, that people just don't understand how to diet. And so once you kind of understand that, you understand these are psychological issues and have to be addressed also as psychological issues. And they're very different issues. Anorexia Katie did as good a job as anybody could explaining sort of the thinking dynamic behind anorexia, sense of perfectionism, high expectations. I'm very proud of Katie that she skipped school today to come be on this and two tests to come
and
in
that
here.
Was hard for you, I gather.
It is a major step in my life.
Okay.
Yeah, they used to like threaten Katie with appointments. She was telling me this morning she would have to go to the treatment appointments because of the anorexia, and that was the most vexing thing for her, that she'd have to miss school.
They made me miss AP European History. I could not believe my parents would do such a terrible thing to me.
Wow. And she's not kidding. I mean, that's the anorexic thinking. Bulimics are in some ways more complicated, and they have a little different family dynamic. And it isn't really she's right. It isn't an effective way to lose weight, and it tends to be a sort of a almost a self-punishing process. I don't know quite how to describe it. It is the bulimics tend to be even more secretive than the anorexics, and most people won't realize that they have a family member that's bulimic. It's such
and this is the purge-gorge syndrome, right, where you eat a lot of food and then discharge it.
Yeah, some people purge without much binging, and other people really do go through the two extremes. Mm-hmm. And some people are kind of opportunistic about bulimia. They'll only do it periodically. And, of course, that's less serious because you're not damaging your esophagus as much if you only do it 4 or 5 times a year. But these are still folks who see that as sort of an emergency backup system to deal with this sense of feeling full. They will always talk about – the bulimics will always talk about this sense of I just felt full and I had to make it go away in a very obsessive way.
Hmm. And Katie, you were saying you were doing both for a while. You went in one direction, then reversed.
Right, right. And that's really unfortunately not because I recognized that I was damaging my body, more just because I noticed that I was actually gaining weight with bulimia instead of losing it.
Yeah. So what did you do then? You clearly recognized there was an issue here. What happened to you?
I started to judge myself more by how I looked than how I felt. And I basically completely ignored my emotions, ignored that I was becoming depressed with my lack of nutrition, and just went kind of crazy for a while. And I was a real brat to my parents. I mean, they would make these great holiday meals and I would just be miserable. And throughout this, I started limiting my calorie intake more and more and more. And if I got like an A minus on a test, I would really starve myself. And after a while, I just lost control. And soon I couldn't even gain weight if I started eating.
And what happened then?
Well, I ended up telling my mom because I was scared. Something that happens after a while with anorexia is that your hair starts to fall out and you start to, I was blacking out sometimes. Like if I'd sit down and try to stand up, I'd just kind of lose all of my vision and senses.
Because you were so hungry, I gather your body didn't have enough nutrition.
Right. Starving.
Yeah.
Starving at that point.
Mm-hmm. And so I was scared. I told my mom, and she's a physical therapist and went to Duke. She's just brilliant, brilliant woman. And so she got me into all the right places, the right doctors, and spent hours on the phone with people trying to find mental health professionals who could help me.
Was that hard in Lawrence or not really?
It was simply because it's a fairly small community and a lot of professionals are already filled up. They can't take any more. Especially with mental health professionals, it was very difficult to find someone. And I actually went through about 4 people before I found a woman who I got along very well with. She's a very nice woman.
And how did that doctor help you begin to turn the page, Katie? What was it that she was saying that began to connect with you in a way that you were able to respond positively to?
I think that what happened is that, well, first off, she didn't talk down to me like I was a child who didn't understand, because that's what some of the other therapists had done.
It drives you crazy,
doesn't
it?
Oh, it does. I mean, as a perfectionist, I cannot stand to be treated like a kindergartner. And she really helped me to realize that food wasn't quite the issue here. It was more my psychological brain fluids. I work differently than some other people do. And she helped me to understand that in order to become healthy physically, I needed to become healthy mentally first.
And what did that entail? I mean, eating, again, was seen as an okay thing to do.
Right. Well, it took a while for them to convince me to start eating on my own. And I'm actually – this doesn't happen with a lot of people, but I'm very grateful that they allowed me to make that decision for myself, because some – of the unluckier anorexics are hospitalized and force-fed.
Because they're so dangerously thin and starving that they've got to do something to intervene.
And if I had lost a few more pounds, I probably would have been in their shoes. But what they really did to turn me – and I have to thank my parents for this mostly, because they would not give up on me even when I was being a brat and throwing fits and not eating – they would just sit me down and talk through it and would never lose their tempers, wouldn't tell me to go to my room and wouldn't, like, try to force food down my throat or anything. But they made me see that what I was doing was actually quite ridiculous and that I was kind of ruining our family dynamic. And they also started to cook foods that had healthy health benefits and show me how this kind of fat is good for your brain, and here's, like, show me all of these superfoods. And I started to trust food a little bit more. I stopped thinking that, like, I wrote in my column that for a while I thought I was, like, Hansel and Gretel being stuffed for the witch's oven. That was literally how I thought.
That was such a good analogy to read it this morning.
At the time.
Oh, absolutely. I thought, oh, they're just trying to fatten me up. But that was not what they were trying to do at all. They were trying to get me back to a healthy weight. And it took a while, but I eventually realized that because they were so supportive.
You know, Katie, from your lowest point in terms of weight itself to the point where you were, again, eating healthily and your weight had returned to a more normal level, how much time passed?
Oh, gosh. I started eating again in the spring of sophomore year, and I don't think I really was stopping my calorie counting until winter of junior year. So about 6 months, I would say.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this because it sounds like for you it was important to maintain a certain level of control in terms of how you were being treated and how you were sort of walking through this process. You weren't willing to give up complete control to the doctors and to your parents. you needed to have some control as you walked along here.
Oh, absolutely. That was a huge problem, actually, because I was very resentful of what my parents were doing with these appointments. As we mentioned before, they would schedule my appointments sometimes during school. And so missing AP European History just drove me into a tizzy.
Because you're a perfectionist and you didn't want to miss class.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
The day that I really turned around, I can pinpoint this day in, I think, April. My mom had taken me out of AP European History to drive to Kansas City, see a psychiatrist, and I was so mad about this that I made her take me out to Cold Stone's to get ice cream. It was my rebellion. I could not stand the thought of being told what to do at any given time.
That's such a good story.
It sounds like you've got a great mom and dad.
Oh, I do.
I'd like to meet them sometime.
Yes, they did everything for me. I could not be more grateful.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I do, a little brother.
And how did he react to all this? Or was he aware of what was going on?
My brother doesn't come out of the basement very often. He plays video games most of the time, so I don't think he even knows I'm here today.
Yeah, he doesn't know what's going on, yeah. Again, maintaining control, Wes, sounds like an essential element of proper treatment here.
This is what it all hinges on. And I think one of the things that's important to understand is we get Katie today as this lovable young woman. She's articulate and she has such perspective on things, which is why we brought her in. And she's already
taught so much
about this. The Katie her parents were dealing with, and I didn't know her at the time. I met her in her interview in April when she was right coming off of this. And we had a very interesting discussion about it. And she was very good in sharing about it. It impressed me. But the Katie that she's describing, the Cold Stone Creamery Katie, was probably not very fun to parent.
Not at all. That is a huge understatement.
And this is how it is with the folks that are afflicted with anorexia. There's a usual family dynamic, and I do not know Katie's family. I just met her mom today. So I don't know how exactly this fits, and you can comment on it. But in general, these are folks that are professionals. They are well-educated. They have very high expectations for themselves, and they have high expectations for their kids. And nothing's wrong with that. They're very nice people always. I don't just mean Katie's family. I mean the anorexic families in general. They're the nicest people you're going to meet. They're not monsters. They're not people who are yelling at their kid, "You've got to get an A," and I'll tell you why. Because the people who yell at their kids, "If you don't get an A, you're worthless," then their kid yells back at them and throws something, and you know, it's the normal family fight. In the anorexic family, the child wants to please the parent, wants to please the family, is very conscientious of that, and wants to be seen in a very positive light. And the expectations are what I call kind of under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody just knows Katie needs to get an A in here. Well, even when the parents realize, you know, that's not that necessary, Katie. It's already baked into the cake.
And what's already baked?
The expectation that the parent will realize, I think we're being, you know, I think our, maybe you don't need to get an A in every class. It's too late. And so the kids are kind of on autopilot by high school in seeing themselves as needing to be at this level. The second problem that comes into play that has to do with control is that there's a failure to resolve conflict. In most families, conflict is resolved by the kid storming out of the room or, you know, throwing something or yelling or dating a bad boyfriend or whatever. And in the anorexic families, conflict, because the child is a pleaser, conflict really can't be resolved overtly. Same with the cutters. They cannot resolve conflict, so they resort to –
You say cutters, you mean people who actually cut their arms.
Yes.
Yeah, that's another issue out there.
Well, it's
issue.
Very yeah. helpful to see them as similar. Mm-hmm. Because cutting is a way of harming your body and anorexia is a way of harming your body. And the thinking style and the failure to resolve conflict is very similar. And so Katie's parents, I think, did a remarkable job by her description. And they were able to circumvent some of the problems families have. They got on it. They got serious about it. And they knew about where to balance the control with her. And I think had Katie not responded to that, then they would have had to up the stakes and she would have lost more control and then she would have been force-fed. She was right down at that point.
Let me get our listeners involved here. If you know someone or perhaps you yourself have gone through one eating disorder or another and can share your story, this would be a great time to do it, maybe help some other folks out as we head into this very busy holiday season here, filled with food, which can be so challenging for some folks. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, I have some personal history with this. A girl, young woman I dated back in the day. This is going back 30 years now. And we dated for a while and came to find out that her description of what she was going through, Katie, was so similar to what you described for me. She also was a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. I think she sort of went in one direction with bulimia for a while, then flip back to sort of the anorexic kind of behavior. And back, you know, tell me if I'm right, Wes, my sense of this, and I could be off, is back in the early 80s, this was something of a new phenomenon. And I remember when I first heard about this and she told me about this, I was just flabbergasted, never having heard of this kind of thing before. I gather today it's a little bit more out there and people are a little bit more aware of all this.
Yeah, you and I are about the same age, so we come out from that same era, and I remember very well. We did not recognize these things, but you have to remember that there's sort of this weird debate in our world today, almost like the global warming debate, you know, what is and isn't controversial. And this idea that suddenly people have all these new disorders that nobody ever had before, ADD, anorexia, depression, bipolar disorder, and that somehow, we just invented these because I need a job or something. That's not true. You're describing a great example of something that wasn't commonly understood, was just barely coming into awareness. And I work with a lot of folks in our age range and a little bit older who had terrible eating problems, eating disorders, and people just thought they were thin.
Yeah.
Just thought they were small.
Yeah.
And, these kinds of issues have been with us for a long time, and we just have a better ability to recognize them and a better technology to deal with them now.
Yeah. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Our topic today, eating disorders among young folks. And it's more common among women than men, I imagine, because what body image is such a more of a preoccupation with women, maybe I'm generalizing here, but more so than with men. Wes, am I right?
You must not go to the same gym I do.
Well, okay. Fair point.
And I say that jokingly, but also seriously. In general, men tend to lean towards exercise anorexia. I do know men who restrict calories, but you'll see a whole lot more of working out using supplements, GNC, products and steroids and all sorts of things to modify that body image. Because for men, a bulked up low fat body image is independent of weight. You can't really weigh yourself and get a sense of whether you're the correct body image or not. So there's an awful lot of checking that out in the mirror.
So you're saying it's not more common with women than
men? It is still more common with women, but it's harder to discern with men who has a body image problem or an anorexia problem or a restriction problem, because exercise anorexia is a real thing too. People who run – and I guess I should just say, and without giving anything away, I see men who have eating disorders, adult men.
In your practice.
Yeah. It's not as rare as you think. It's just not what we usually think of. So, and people who run a lot, I'm not saying they all have anorexia at all. That's a fine thing. I should do more of it myself. But that's something you watch for if that becomes obsessive. Think obsessive. That's the word.
That's the key word here. Okay, lots of phone calls as we talk about body image and eating disorders. Let's go to Rich from Overland Park. Rich, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. First of all, let me say I work with kids, and your screener asked me what I do with them. I'd rather not say because it would possibly impinge on people I work with. But
I understand.
But I think this is an exceedingly interesting discussion, and I'm glad you put it on, Steve. And I would ask this gentleman, when does perfectionism become pathological? Because I deal with that a lot.
What a great question.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the whole perfection thing, and the gentleman here is Dr. Wes Crenshaw. Wes, go ahead.
Well, it is a great question. The problem is, as with most great questions we get on this show, it has a difficult answer. When it impairs you, when it harms you, because one person's perfectionism is another person's conscientiousness. The best thing you can get on a job application or referral from someone is that this person was a conscientious worker. That's the best word ever. Research proves that out. So conscientious is a form of obsessive. So if you think about anxiety disorders as people who just care too much, that's really what an anxiety disorder is. At the point you care so much that it begins to damage your life, then it reaches the pathological level. Now, that's hard to assess, but that's the nature of understanding anxiety, any anxiety disorder, and anorexia is a kind of anxiety or obsessive disorder.
Katie, can you recall for yourself when your drive for perfection began to override your own health?
You know, I think it probably happened somewhere in the eighth grade, because I know in seventh grade I was still – I mean, you think of a seventh grader being a perfectionist and it's kind of a silly picture, but I was still very obsessed with getting good grades even though I knew they wouldn't show up on college transcripts. But then for some reason, eighth grade hit, and I actually did not have very difficult classes. Eighth grade was one of my easiest years, but I guess it was so easy that I became obsessed with getting 100% on everything. I thought, well, if I'm not getting 100%, then I must be stupid. But that was a really unrealistic viewpoint. But unfortunately, it carried on into the rest of my years because I got used to getting 100, 100, 100. And then ninth grade came, and that wasn't happening anymore.
Did you express that, your sort of drive for perfection, to your family? I mean, was there concern from your parents saying, oh, Katie, you're doing great. You know, you don't have to be perfect on everything you're doing here.
You know, it's funny. My mom has said for years that the day I get a B on a test, she will throw a party.
I have that same deal with a couple of my clients. I tell them I will bring you any dessert you want if you get a B. That is such a good point. We had a case one time where we had to hide the young person's textbooks in a locked cabinet. And darned if she didn't find the key. And the parents found her up in her room with a flashlight in bed reading those textbooks. We're all for learning, but the caller's point about when that becomes pathological, there's a good example.
Rich, are we getting there?
Question.
Yeah.
I just one more question.
Yeah.
I don't want to use her client, but the relationship with a child who was OCD, and her behavior was that she would make her bed but would be unwilling to sleep on it because she would mess it up. And isn't that a little bit similar to what we're talking about here?
But more than most listeners will realize, and Katie was nodding while you were saying that whatever your thing is that makes your anxiety go down, that you can fix, is potential for an obsession. If seeing your bed look that way reduces your anxiety, that's where the obsession comes from. And for Katie, making her weight something she could control felt good. You liked that.
Absolutely. And it would have been healthier if mine had been a cleanliness thing. I think my mom would have preferred that, because I can tell you that my room does not look like the room of someone who suffers from OCD.
Anyway, thanks very much.
Such learning.
Rich, I'm glad you called.
Thank
you for the phone call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here about eating disorders and how young folks can deal with that. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, up to date. At kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Our topic today, young folks and eating disorders. The holidays are coming. Lots of food. It's a difficult time for folks who struggle with this. Our guest again, Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He co-authors the Double Take Advice column for teens for the Lawrence Journal World. And Katie Gio, she's worked with Wes on the Double Take column. She has a column today in the Lawrence Journal World that deals with all of this. She's a senior at the Free State High School over in Lawrence. Let's go back to some phone calls. Lots of good folks here calling. Bob from Kansas City, Missouri. Bob, you're on the air. Good morning. You there, Bob? Let's go to Meredith from Kansas City North. Meredith, good morning to you.
Good morning. I just want to say I'm trained as a therapist, and I one of the things I noticed when I was going to grad school was that actually the technical diagnostic difference between anorexia and bulimia is weight. I mean, it's not whether or not you throw up, it's weight. And it sounds like your guest that in his practice he may, you know, they may differentiate that differently. But one thing that I remember from an undergraduate class, an adolescent psych class, they mentioned, my instructor mentioned a study they had done where they had taken college students and models and taken a whole bunch of measurements, you know, weight, height, leg length, waist length, mm-hmm. Et cetera. And then they had compared the general population with the models and found out that about half of the boys fit into the same range as the models, whereas only less than 10% of the girls did. And I think more than anything, that probably accounts for the fact that more girls than boys end up with this, just because our societal criteria for beauty in women is so much less realistic.
Hmm. Well, this is a fine time to speak on the issue of media. That's a good little piece of research the caller shared.
Yeah.
And this is another of the sort of myths of anorexia that is – It is a relevant myth, but it's still a little bit of a myth, is that the media drives anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders. And here the myth part of that is that these are multivariate equations. Multiple things come into place. I talked about the family dynamic. Another dynamic is the media, that if you're a perfectionistic person, if you're Katie, and you look at the cover of Cosmo or 17 or whatever, and you see these people who have been not only, you know, they have a personal trainer and they're photoshopped and all these things, that plays into your thing. That plays into your obsession. So that helps you form your practice of anorexia, but it doesn't reach out and grab people. Now, where that does cause a problem is in the sort of subclinical cases where kids are feeling bad about themselves because mm-hmm. they don't meet up to all those measurements. But it's just one of the pieces that plays into the disorder that we're talking about today. It's not really its cause.
Yeah.
Well, I mean.
Go ahead, Meredith.
I'm sorry. I mean, no, you know, not any more than like Joe Camel causes kids
right.
to smoke, but it does, I think, maybe set up a,
I would call it a target.
Set up a target. Whereas, you know, I know that in cases of boys who have eating disorders, it's very often in sports. You know, in places mm-hmm. where they're expected, you know, like wrestling or something mm-hmm. where they're expected to maintain a certain weight, or, you know, in areas where, you know, they're expected to, you know, and I know that like things like steroids play into that more, because it's more about gaining muscle mass than necessarily losing weight,
right.
because that's the criteria for boys.
Right. Yeah. And I would use the word target, that this gives the person who's obsessed a target to shoot for, and all kids in general probably a false reality for what they should shoot for.
Meredith, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Email UpToDate at KCUR.org. We're talking about eating disorders this morning. Let's go to Sarah from Lawrence. Sarah, you're on the program with Dr. Wes Crenshaw and Katie Gio. Good morning.
Good morning. The reason for my call is I was just listening, and I am a 50-year-old woman, and I have battled anorexia and was in treatment for three times, and finally in 2000, I was in, finally got serious about it because I literally almost died. I'm lucky to be alive, and I've been fine now for 12, 13 years, but I remember going through treatments, and I think I'm glad to see some changes, but one problem that I had was affording treatment because you cannot be cured in 2 weeks, and they put you in a treatment facility, and insurance won't cover it. At one point, my husband and I had to take out a loan so that I could stay in treatment, and even then, we could barely afford it. I was lucky enough to have a family to support me and had to pay out of pocket a lot of money to be okay now. But I think that's something that I'm glad to hear that your guest there is fine. But if it's not treated, it only gets worse. And these 2 week stays and out the door, which is what I saw when I was able to stay for a good 3 or 4 months to really get help, are not gonna fix the problem. And you're just gonna have this girl or young adolescent continue the disorder.
Well, we need to talk. The caller brings up a great point, and not only does it validate what Steve and I were talking about earlier with folks of our generation, you know, you are of our generation having this problem over the course of time. You also point out that for some people this is a lifelong problem, and we don't know with Katie, you know, you'll probably be thinking about this in the future and watching out for it. How much it will come back to affect you, we don't know. But for a lot of people, it keeps on keeping on. And I know people in our age range who just are constantly re-dealing with this, constantly, almost like the alcoholics talk about having to always be aware of recovery. So one of the things we need to be aware of is that this disorder, all eating disorders, have a fairly broad range of impairment. We will see people – by the way, this is true with cutting also. We'll see people who dabble in this and sort of – in their teens and young adulthood, get a little bit of a start in it. And then we see people who get really addicted to it. It's kind of addictive.
Yeah.
And stick with it and are constantly fighting it for years and years to come. And early intervention really does help. The caller talks about the difficulties of affording that. There are many schools of thought on whether long-term inpatient treatment is actually effective in the long run.
Why wouldn't it be?
Well, because it's a lot easier to get better and stay better when people are following you around, making you eat what you're supposed to and reinforcing you for that. And the minute you get out...
In institutionalized care, you're saying.
Right.
The
minute you get out, if there's not a good aftercare program in place, then you revert to your wild state. Mm-hmm. And so this is the problem of inpatient treatment. Believe you me, I'm not here to defend third-party reimbursers today, but this is why they have quit wanting to pay for long-term care. This is why certain large psychiatric hospitals in our area no longer are here, because that was their model, and insurance companies have not been able to see outcomes that they can justify that.
Huh. So long-term care isn't an option in many cases.
Inpatient
long-term care. What about just folks around the country who need help for this? Is it hard to find? Katie, you said that your situation was you had a hard time finding help. A lot of doctors already had full practices. You couldn't get in to see certain people. How tough was it for you to actually find folks who could help you?
My mom is lucky because as a physical therapist, she has a lot of connections in the medical field, but it was still tough. And so I imagine that people who have no experience in the medical field have an incredibly hard time finding just the right fit. And with money being an object, I mean, in my family, I'm quite parsimonious, and I don't have a job, but I'm still very money conscious. And so... The idea that we were spending money on a doctor and a therapist and a nutritionist scared me to death. And so for families who are in tough financial times, I can imagine that could be a huge concern.
And, yeah. and the other thing to mention without going into specifics, Katie's HMO has an extremely restrictive mental health board that doesn't allow anybody to be seen outside of Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had an argument with them for other cases, and they seem to think that's pretty neat. Mm-hmm. And that really isn't helpful when you live in Lawrence or anywhere else and your insurance is based in Kansas City. So that was another problem they ran into, not unlike what the caller was struggling with.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, thank you for the phone call.
Sure.
Appreciate Thanks. It. Yeah, good luck. Yeah, bye-bye. Yeah, I'm just wondering, how do you think your story will go over with your classmates at Lawrence Free State? I mean, what kind of response do you expect to get here? And I'm wondering, in terms of, are kids going to be open and accepting of sort of the struggles that you faced?
You know, I've been wondering about that for a while.
I bet.
The only reason that I haven't told anyone since I got better is because it's not really something that comes up in casual conversation. And after a while, it kind of seemed like, well, if I bring it up now, people are going to wonder why I didn't tell them earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So I just figured, you know, I'd wait until a convenient time came across. And I guess today just happened to be that day. So I'm not sure how many of my friends will know immediately, but I have a great supportive bunch of friends, and I also really like the community in
yeah.
which I go to school. And so while I imagine that, I mean, there are probably a few people who will not understand, there are many more who will. And I think that's great, because the whole reason that I want to share this story is because it is becoming imperative that eating disorder sufferers go out there with their stories in order to get rid of that shame and the idea that you need to keep it a secret, because the only way you get better is to get outside support.
Well, Katie, that takes guts, and I sure admire what you're doing today.
Thank you.
Just terrific. And, you know, my sense, having two boys in high school, and this is, again, speaking very broadly, is that, you know, kids these days seem a lot more open to the notion that, you know, different people have different struggles and much more accepting about those things than when I was a kid was. I mean,
I think this is the counterpoint to our show a few months ago on bullying, where
yeah.
bullying people zero in on folks' weakness and
mm-hmm.
exploit that. It that does happen. It's a serious problem. But the nice counterpoint you just made, and that is that the kids are more accepting of people with different problems and lifestyles and issues. There are days I think it gets a little weird. I don't know if this happens at Free State, but I will overhear kids sitting around talking about which medication they're on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that does get a little awkward sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, like,
really?
Have you tried Cymbalta? It's a lot better than Effexor.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
And so in one sense, I like the fact that the stigma for mental health is far for mental health treatment is far less for teens and young adults now than
I mean, thank
it
goodness.
Ever has been.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Back to some phone calls here. Again, our topic today on Up to Date, eating disorders with young people. Phyllis from Kansas City, Missouri. Phyllis, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Wes, a question on follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
I have a second cousin who suffered with anorexia in high school, got over it, apparently, but not completely,
right.
because later in life, she's now in her early 30s, she had a situation where a new boss that came in was very critical of her, and she had problems, health problems again, and finally took a new job. But the upshot is that anorexia apparently has come back. We recently had a family reunion, and I noticed how thin she was when everybody else was eating breakfast together. She went for a walk that night when we were doing a nice fish chowder in Seattle. She had to make sure that it had a tomato base and not a cream base, and I said something to her mother about it, and I said, look, I want to check with you first, but should I mention this to your daughter? And I mentioned that because when she was in high school, she thought because the extended family didn't say anything to her that she looked poorly, that she must look okay. But, you know, we didn't go around saying, child, you look like you just were escaped from Auschwitz. What is the role of outside family members, you know, extended family members, to be supportive but not do something destructive?
How old is she now?
She's probably 32 or 33, and she has a 10-year-old son who's in good health.
Well, you raised several points, some of them that you realize and one of them you probably don't. Let me toss in this one first. Generally, if you have a child in a home with an eating disorder, you're going to find a parent with an eating disorder. And that will never have been discussed, but it will come through either kind of at the under the radar level, or it will come through overtly where they're like, oh, you know, I just think you're putting on some weight and you want to watch out for that. So it's important that adults who have kids continue to really work on their recovery, or else it'll just leak out all over the place. And this may be what is happening with your cousin. You said it was a cousin, right?
Yeah, it's my cousin's daughter. And I do know that my cousin had not anorexia. She just is allergic to almost everything under the sun and has to rotate foods to find something that won't poison her.
So food's a big focal point.
Yeah, it is.
And so I think your point is well taken, where people don't notice. Like, Katie, you said that you finally went to your parents and said, wow, I've got a problem, and you were 89 pounds, and you have lovely parents. I just have to ask, how did they not notice that? It's kind of relevant
actually,
to this issue.
I went to them when I was 100 pounds, but still they had noticed. I think that deep down they realized that something was wrong, and that this wasn't just dieting, but they didn't want to believe that their daughter was injuring herself in this way.
Right. Yeah. That's actually exactly the answer I've suspected. So I think, Phyllis, if you say something in a kind way, that may put an idea in her head to be interested and concerned about it. Generally, folks don't jump up and thank you for that. So you might want to be cautious and pick the right moment.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, if you get that kind of feedback, that may be what she needs to hear to realize that problem is reasserting itself.
Well, I appreciate that, because I wondered whether saying anything, since she's now in therapy again, would just muddy the water.
Well, if she's back in therapy, you may not have as big a worry about that. Maybe that's getting discussed, because I'll tell you what, and it may be the population I work with, young people, but I check people's weight out every week I see them. And in our society, it's a lot easier to ask somebody how come they've lost some weight than to be concerned about them having gained some.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis, thank you for the good call.
Thank you.
All the best. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Roxy emailed us this. I'm 56 years old and was bulimic back around 74, 75. Mm-hmm. I searched in my college library until I found a very old book on anorexia, and that was the only information I could find close to what I was experiencing. I cured myself a few years later. I'm so thankful there's information and help for young people going through this today. Karen in Kansas City North emailed a reminder about another eating disorder. It's important to remember that not all eating disorders are about striving to be thin. Many obese people also have eating disorders which are not treated. Unfortunately, in today's society, obesity is seen as a choice that people make and not as a disease to help people fight. For many people, this is not the case.
Great point. Mm-hmm. And it is a real problematic conundrum in our business and in media and everywhere else. We want to speak to the majority or the large plurality of kids and young adults that are not mm-hmm. in a healthy weight, and we want to say that's not a good thing. You know, I hope you guys don't think I'm real big looking at me today, but I do have type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, and that's genetic for me, but I'm very aware of how much that is a problem in our society and very concerned about it.
Yeah.
So we want people to do all they can to reduce their chances of that. Unfortunately, by really pushing this issue, the anorexic people are listening to the same message. The bulimic people are listening to the same message. So they hear, well, you know, everybody's too fat. Fat, yeah. Fat, 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 fat. And they think, okay, I can solve that problem. So it's almost like you can't block the hearing of one group to speak to the other. So if you say people are too thin, anorexia is bad, then, you know, the obese people think, well, at least I don't have that problem.
Yeah.
So it is really, when we talk about eating disorders, it's true. We're talking about a really wide range of problems, and some of those aren't just voluntary. But it is easier in our society to talk to people about anorexia than overeating.
You know, Katie, we've kissed this idea during the course of this hour, but this idea that many addicts who recover from one symptom of their disease, like anorexia, they often substitute another addiction for it. Have you had an issue with that or not?
You know, knock on wood, so far I haven't really. If anything, I've developed an addiction to chocolate and almonds, but that is another story.
Yeah, okay.
What about advanced placement classes? You seem to be addicted to that.
Actually, no, I'm only taking three, which is less than most people. I definitely have had to step back and say, I don't need to be in six advanced placement classes. I'll just pick the ones that I want to be in, and I really try. It's a conscious decision always, and I have to be completely aware of what I'm doing and making sure that what I'm doing academically is healthy for me.
Mm-hmm. What about this notion of substituting addictions, basically, Wes?
Yeah, I must say, Katie, that was beautifully put and well thought through. People will switch over to other things. If you have a basic obsessive tendency, it's easy to switch to something else, sex or shopping or, you know, whatever it may be. But those things tend to have a different problem set. The eating really seems – people seem really stuck in that over the course of time, as an earlier caller mentioned. And so once you get that beat – it isn't quite as much symptom substitution as you might think.
We just have a minute left here, Wes, so let's be brief here. Ann wants to know, what are the panelists' thoughts regarding 12-step support groups for anorexia and bulimia recovery? Just real quick.
I haven't ever used that before, but then again, the age groups I work in, it's largely a family therapy model.
Yeah.
And I strongly recommend family therapy as a core element in all treatment for eating disorders.
So you're not sure about the 12-step, though?
Yeah, I've never tried that one.
Alana from Independence. Alana, go quickly if you would.
Hi, I just wanted to say something about how I think doctors can actually foster a culture of disordered eating. I mean, people talk about anorexia as a thin person's disease, but that doesn't mean that people who are obese don't hear all these messages. And if you're eating 400 calories a day and no one notices because you're 200 pounds but you're not losing weight, that can actually be very, very damaging. And even if you're And doctors will say, well, you're being healthy. You're trying to lose weight when you're actually killing your body by not taking in enough nutrients.
Well, that's exactly the point I was making a minute ago, that the messages overlap and sometimes to one's detriment.
Yeah. Hey, we're out of time. Katie, Gio, thanks so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate you sharing our story.
Thank you.
You just did a great job.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Wes, always good to have you, too.
Yeah, read us every week in the paper.
You bet. That's Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He's talking about the Lawrence Journal World, where his column appears each week. You can follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, we'll look at how Anheuser-Busch developed a beer developed a head and how it started to go flat. The story, the show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.